following message is from a guest speaker of Emmanuel Community Church. More information about the ministry of Emmanuel Community Church can be found at emmanuelcommunity.org.
My name is Pastor Praise. I have the privilege of leading the Catalyst youth group, high school youth group ministry here at ICC. And today we are starting the Advent series of the church. So I'm the first one, I guess, you know, they gave me this one because a lot of the church members are still on holiday from Thanksgiving. So yeah, I've got the easy role here today to make a lot of mistakes because our head pastor's not here as well. So yeah, if it goes up on the internet, just make sure you cut it off over there at the AV Center. But yeah, one thing I think for me as I, you know, Advent, Christmas is always something that we look forward to. And entering to the season of Advent, if you're like me who grew up in the church, you might think Advent is just like this countdown to Christmas. Jesus' birthday, it's the chocolate calendar, the decorations, the family Christmas card photos that you send out to all your friends and families, the carols. But historically, Advent is actually a season of groaning, this longing. It is a season of waiting. Advent, it is a church collectively acknowledging that the world is not as it should be. And we are aching for the light to break in. We're desperate for God to intervene. So today, the title of this message is Emmanuel, the God who enter our mess. But to understand this concept of Emmanuel, we have to understand the moment that we are actually living in here, the now, the today. And theologically, we call this inaugurated eschatology. This is a big phrase. It's a theological term that they teach you in seminary. But to give you a picture of what it feels like, what this actually means, I want to share a story. This was around 3 years ago when I first came to the Chicagolands. And Harmon, for those who don't know, he was the youth leader before me. He's one of the parents of one of our kids. And he took me to the GBN volleyball competition or something that was happening. They were versing another school. And we were supposed to have dinner that night. And he said, hey, come watch, because there's going to be a lot of our students who attend GBN. They're going to actually play in this game. So I was like, sure. And I was looking at the time, and I was like, do we actually have enough time? Because, like, I'm about to head off to have dinner with you. Like, and he's like, don't worry, Praise, don't worry. And the reason is this. He's like, GBN was, like, kind of up there in the rankings. Apparently, they're really good. And the team that they were facing, like, they're in the bottom of the roster. So Harmon, you know, his eldest son was actually playing for the game team as well. So he's like, no, we're good. We're fine. It's probably going to take, I don't know, 30 minutes, you know. And we walk in full of confidence. And sure enough, yeah, the atmosphere was so good. I think the opposition kind of already knew that they were going to lose because, like, nobody came to cheer them on. You know, so they are already, like, we are walking in there like, okay, we got this, you know. And you can tell by Harmon's posture, because in the beginning, you know, he's sitting on the pews like this. Is like, let's go, guys, let's go. You know, like kind of like that. But what's interesting, as the game progresses, look, I don't really know about the rules of volleyball, right? I don't know, but I know enough when a team is losing, right? I know enough. And the what was supposed to be like an easy win, like, it was like, you know what I mean? Like, getting up there. And I knew something wasn't right was when Harmon's posture, when he was like kind of like this, and all of a sudden he's like this. You know, he's like shaking, and you could tell because he's like, oh, you know, and he has these moments, these reactions to what was going on. So, you know, the game goes on, the first, we win, okay, so, whew. But the second, it's like, we were like losing for a moment there, and that's when I was like, yo, Wait, I thought this was the easy game. I thought it was guaranteed. I thought we had the sure victory. That's why our posture, the attitude, the way we entered into the space was like as if we already won. Therefore, we planned the dinner like 30 minutes later, all that. It was guaranteed. The stats showed it. The history showed it. The reality showed it. Thankfully, we won. We did. But I'll tell you that the moment in that room was tense. We were sweating. The outcome was guaranteed. GBN should have won. And they did. But the experience was throughout this tension. From the beginning and to the end, that space in the middle was tense. Could we? Can we? I know we will, but there was full of doubts. I know, like the paper says so, it's facts, yet still in the reality when we're viewing in first person, we couldn't help but have moments. This is inaugurated eschatology. The best way to describe it is by Oscar Coleman, a theologian who first coined this idea in explaining this by D-Day versus V-Day. So during World War II, the term D-Day was first introduced to the world. D-Day marked the launch of the special mission called the Battle of Normandy. Normandy was on the northern coast of France, and historians will often say, whoever won this battle on this beach will win the war. It opened the path to the Western Europe. It was one of the bloodiest military operation in history with around 400K plus casualties on both sides. Now, once the beach was secured by the Allied forces, the German forces began to retreat and the Allied pushed. Months later, liberated Paris. And so on. We know the rest of the history. But here's the thing. Even though the victory on D-Day guaranteed the outcome of the entire war, the actual V-Day, the victory day, did not arrive until almost a year later, 1945. And in between that time, there's still battles, still losses, and the final result was already sealed by this D-Day. Coleman said that this is how the kingdom works in the now as we hope and anticipate for Jesus coming back. In the first coming of Jesus 2,000 years ago on the cross, God's decisive victory has already happened. In the second coming, the full and final victory will be seen. And currently, we live in the space in between the already and not yet. The Bible tells us that when Jesus died and rose again, D-Day happened. The beach was stormed, the enemy was defeated, and theologically we stand on firm ground. We know Jesus has conquered sin and death. We know he is seated at the right hand of the Father for glory and power. We know the curse of death has been broken. That is the already, that is the scoreboard saying victory for us. But we are still playing the second set. We are still in the not yet. And this is where the tension tears us apart. Because if we are honest, if we're truly honest, we look at the theology and we look at our lives and the math sometimes doesn't seem to add up. Sometimes it doesn't make sense, just like it was at the GBN game. Because deep inside, we harbor the question that kind of haunts us in the quiet. Jesus, if you are indeed ruling with power, why is there brokenness around me? If you are on the throne, why? Why is there illness in my family? Why, Lord, is my child wandering away from faith? Why, Lord, is my marriage falling apart? Why is my work so fruitless? If the victory is won, why does it feel like I'm losing the battle? Deep inside, don't we all have this? And to be honest with you, even myself included, I'm a part of this. I say this, I question this. You know, I feel the pressure as a pastor, as a leader for our youth to hide this. There's a voice in my head that says, come on, man, you know better. You're a pastor. You went to seminary. You shouldn't waver. Maybe others can doubt, but you, no, not you. You can't. And I feel this obligation to protect God's reputation. So I find myself forcing it. I find myself trying to muster up faith, muster up hope, because it's the Christian thing to do. So I try to just thug it out, muscle my way to this positive attitude type of thing. I suppress a lot of these questions, these confusions. I shove the doubt down to the basement of my heart because I'm afraid that if I admit I'm confused, if I admit that I am indeed doubting, I am somehow failing God. Sometimes I think if I just had enough faith, I wouldn't feel this tension. But church, this is a lie. The tension that we feel in the in-between isn't a lack of faith. No, simply the tension is just the reality of the age we live in. As long as we have this thing called flesh on our bodies, this is the reality. And this is where the message of Christmas, the message of Emmanuel, actually comes in and embraces us in the midst of those questions. Recently, my Old Testament professor, Dr. McGarry, he's a legend in the Hebrew language department. He's one of the guys who helped translate the ESV. ESV is the best one, by the way, the extra spiritual version. Yep. But he gave us a lecture on the book of Psalms. Now, I know a lot of us know that, and it's common language, a common knowledge that we know the book of Psalms as the book of praises, right? It's like the collective worship songs, if you could say. And Israel, throughout history, would use it and sing these songs, these poetry, these poetic psalms during festivals or other moments of worship towards God. But what is interesting is that in some of the psalms, in the middle of some of these praises, there is this thing called lament. Lament. Lament, for those who don't know, is a language of complaint and grief. It is what we cry when life hurts. It's those groaning, the sounds that we make when we can't pretend everything is fine. It is the anthem that we sing in the age of tension that we live today. So what we see in these lament, these psalms, typically, so it starts with this lament, but it turns as a praise at the end. So for example, Psalms 13, if you read it here, so this is how it usually works. So it starts off with this complaint, this rawness, right? Like, oh, like, how long, oh Lord, would you forget me forever? This is the groaning. It's the feeling of rejection. It's the pain and the suffering that we all human go to and can relate with this statement. But then it turns at the end. Okay, there's a resolution. You know, and it's like, oh, and as a reader, we like this. Okay, the pain, the suffering later on came to a word of praise. It came to a reconciliation of acknowledging who God is. So at the end, as you can see in Psalms 13, but I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord, for he has been good to me. It's good. We like this. We like this type of songs. We don't like to just remain in this awkward place. However, there are 8 specific psalms in the Bible that actually doesn't turn the corner. These are the songs of complaint. These are the words that contain accusation at God. It starts with it and it will end with it. And the readers, when we read this, it makes us uncomfortable. I mean, if you just look at some of these psalms here, it says, have you sold your people for nothing? Have you broken the covenant? God, Yahweh, the people around me mock me, taunt me, and after my life. Lord, where is your steadfast love? Why aren't you rescuing me? Lord, are you asleep? Wake up. And like I said, these Psalms, it starts there. And as a reader, you want some reconciliation. You want some redemption. You want for this to be praises. But at the end, it just ends there. It ends with more of this. And I get it. It feels very scandalous, doesn't it? I get it. It feels blasphemous even. Like, how dare we? We actually accuse, blame, and complain to this cosmic being? How dare we? The audacity that we feel within these Psalms. The language is so raw, it's so wild that scholar Walter Brueggemann, he famously stated this. He said, "Who thought it was a good idea to include these in the canon?" That's how we all feel. Why? We can't allow that to just remain there. We have to muster up our faith, right? We have to at least force it that God is good, even though we don't see it. That's the Christian thing to do. So why? Why are they there? Perhaps it's because God knows that in the in-between age, in the age of tension that we live right now, you are going to feel things that hallelujahs can't cover. To this lecture, Dr. McGarry ends it with this. He says, the real threat is not blasphemy. The greatest threat to any relationship is silence. It ruins friendship. It ruins marriages. And God's people have a way of giving God the silent treatment. Church, God isn't offended by your tension. He isn't offended by our whys. He is Emmanuel, God with us. He is with us in the victory, yes, absolutely, but he is also with us in the tension of the second set. What he's saying to us is, don't muster it up. Don't fake it. Meet me with your hurt, your pain, your confusion, your doubt, and allow me to handle the mess you can't fix. Now, how do we actually navigate this? Like, how do we even practically apply this? See, if we are truly living in the age of tension, where the victory is secured, yet the suffering, the pain, and the confusion are still so real, we question, then what are we supposed to do? What are the options that we have? Do we just sit in sadness, or do we ignore it and pretend to be happy? How do we walk into work or the cold space air in your own homes or in the dreadful hospital room that you have to go and meet your loved one, holding both the reality of the resurrection and the reality of the brokenness without losing our minds, without losing our faith? How are we to go about this? What do we do? And to answer that, I want to kind of take you back to the volleyball court one last time. It was another game that I saw watching, and it was one of our high school boys, Jaden Han. And it was another one of those games that we were kind of losing, you know, GBN was losing. And honestly, the vibe was heavy. It was. You know, the scoreboard looked bad. You could feel the anxiety in the room. And there was a moment. There was Jaden's turn to serve. Now, I want you guys to moment. Like, just imagine. They need this point badly. The gym is dead quiet. The pressure suffocating. Everyone doing the hum and shake right now, you know, like this, anticipating. It feels like we're going to lose the second set. And right before he tosses the ball to serve, all of a sudden, Jaden looks at me. And this is what he said, "Praise!" And I was like, "Inaugurated eschatology!" Everyone stand was like, "Whoa, so confused, like inaugurated who, like what's going on, like, you know, and guys, you have to understand, this wasn't like one of those like let's go, like, you know, it wasn't one of those hype moments of like, we got this. It was inaugurated eschatology, right? And truth be told, I was a little embarrassed, I'm not gonna lie. Like, there was like a moment where I was like, okay, yeah, like, yeah, all right, good, come, yeah, I got you, inaugurated eschatology, yeah. And it was that moment, you know. In a losing game, with a smile, he just points at me with full confidence, as with like, doesn't care if no one gets this word, he knows it. And he just tosses it up, and did he serve? Did he serve? And they won that game. Now, what I love about this is not that we won. Again, guys, it was guaranteed. But in that moment of tension, Jaden wasn't just serving, playing, living out of a fantasy. He didn't deny the score to ignore it. No, he was sweating. He was in a mess. He was in tension. But he chose to anchor himself in the future reality. He was saying, I acknowledge the battle. Yes, this is hard. I am frustrated. I am disappointed. But I'm playing this point. And I'm playing this. I'm serving this ball from a place of victory. Perhaps, church, this is the posture of hope. This is the posture of Advent. We don't ignore the illness. We don't ignore the cold marriage. We don't ignore the prodigal child. We actually lament it. We bring the pain to God. We break the silence. But we do not grieve as those who have no hope. We look at the scoreboard of the resurrection and we remember Christ has come, and we remember that Christ is coming again to wipe every tear from our eyes. And with that truth and with that reality in our lungs, we go and serve the ball. We go and we love our neighbor in light of that truth. We go and enjoy our families in light of that truth. We go show up to our Mondays, face our colleagues, our manager in light of that truth. We live in the tension fueled by the victory, by that reality. So as we close, if the worship team could you come up. Church, could we all stand, and as we close this off, and we're going to end with worship. I would like to speak specifically to the people here in this room. For a long time, just like me, you just grew up in this church and we had to be forced to muster it up. You've been carrying a heaviness, perhaps, about your kids, about your school, your job, your career, your family, your future. And you felt like you have to be the strong one for everyone else around you. And maybe this year, this Christmas season will be one of the most loneliest, the most broken, and the coldest season for you guys. But today, Emmanuel reminds us. He wants to meet you, and he is also there. He's there in the tension. You don't have to fix it. Sometimes it's beyond us. But if anything, all he asks from us, is just, could you break that silence? Could you break this silence between me?